Welcome to The Young
and the Weary,
the podcast where we explore life and comedy through the eyes of me, Jeremy Pinsley, a 32-year-old stand-up comedian from Nashville, Tennessee, and Dev Rogers, an 88-year-old comedic actress living here in the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
That's it, I'm 88 years old. Oh, it's bagel time. Oy vey.
Hey gang, welcome back to part two of our episode with Lisa Dopolito. Lisa went from acting to advertising to starting her own production company to making the amazing documentary Love Gilda about the one and only comedian Gilda Radner. Lisa is an example of someone who never said no. She took 4 years to make this documentary. She raised the money by herself, and what she created was absolutely unbelievable. I hope you all check out the documentary Love Gilda. It's on Hulu. It's on Amazon. And I also hope you really enjoy listening to this episode about Lisa's experience making the documentary and what we can all learn from Gilda Radner.
I wanted to interview Gene Wilder for a while, and Gilda's brother and her good friends and her cancer therapist and Gilda's club were all emailing him, asking him if he would be interviewed or meet me, and no one heard back from him for about a couple years. And then I was in Los Angeles, and I was working on a commercial, and I got a call from Gene Wilder's wife, Karen, and she said, oh, Gene wants to see you on Saturday. And I said, oh my God, I'm in LA, and I'm doing this commercial, and can I come, I'll be back, can I come the next week? And she said, well, Gene has some cognitive issues, and we don't know what he'll be like, but, you know, call me the day before, and we'll see. Which I was like, oh my God. And it's pretty well known now that Gene had dementia. He had Alzheimer's. And I called the day before, and Karen, who's lovely, said, yes, come tomorrow. You know, and I was able to spend the day with Gene. And he was pretty lucid at most times. Like, he was just the sweetest, kindest, handsome man, even though he was in really poor physical shape. He turned and I walked in the room and he turned and looked at me. He had beautiful blue eyes and he said, you look like a little girl. And it just made me feel, because I was so nervous. He was the one I was nervous meeting. I wasn't nervous about meeting anyone else in the whole film, but I was really nervous about meeting him. And when he said that, it just made me feel relaxed and he was lovely. His wife, Karen, was lovely. And I spent the whole day with them. And at the end of the day, Gene and I couldn't have filmed him, and I couldn't have even recorded him because it wouldn't have been right. But him and I just sat in the garden together with his two dogs. And we just sat there and it was the house that Gilda's house originally before it was even Gene moved into that house with her. And it was just lovely.
That's an amazing experience. I don't think many people get to say they had.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad because I've never met Gilda and I never met Gene, you know, I always saw it as a love story. Their story is a love story because in all of Gilda's audio tapes and all her writings about Gene, she loved him. She adored him. And, you know, friends have different, you know, like friends have different opinions about, like, people's husbands. And so I never got a really good idea of what was true. But meeting Gene, I could see, like, why Gilda loved him. I could see his love for her. I could see the unique, like, they're both like this, there's something childlike about them. And it wasn't because he had Alzheimer's. It's just this kind of whimsical, I don't know how to explain it, but like just a goodness and an innocence that I think is very rare. So I can imagine the two of them together, though, you know, relationships are complicated and they were very different from what I've heard. I could just imagine how wonderful it was for Gilda to have him and how wonderful it was for him to have her.
That's terrific to hear. Yes, thank you.
One of my favorite, because in reading the book, there was a moment when you're kind of amazed of how calm and good of a husband Gene is throughout that whole process of the cancer. And she told the story where when she was a kid, her family would go to the beach in Miami, and there was identical umbrellas, and she could never find her parents, so they tied shoes to the top, and then she would, that way she could find them. And then when she was in the cancer bed in the hospital, she was in the hospital, he came and brought a pink umbrella with shoes tied. And I, like, that was one of those moments where my heart dropped. I was like, I love you, Gene. Marry me, Gene Wilder.
Oh, wow.
Was there anyone else that you wanted to work with? Were there, because you had Bill Hader and Amy Poehler, a lot of the SNL cast. And I know people probably were curious about Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, too.
Yeah, from the modern day comedians, I got everybody I really wanted, except I did want Tina Fey, but Tina opened the film at Tribeca and gave this amazing speech about the film, so I feel like she's part of the film. In terms of, I really wanted Bill Murray. But everybody in his life would say, you're never going to get him. Like, and I would call the 1-800 number, and my producers would call whoever they could call, and we never got him. But
yes, I mean, you know, it's unfortunate because you also just, they had an interesting relationship because they dated for a while too. So you would think, you would hope he would have found that extra will to come by. But
I'm not sure guys are so open about being interviewed about ex-girlfriends that they may not have been that nice to.
Yeah, I guess there was a bit of that in there too.
What makes you finish off by saying he was, might not have been that nice to her?
Well, I mean, in the film we talk about how he had another girlfriend while he had Gilda. But apparently they had, there were people who I interviewed who said he wasn't very nice to her. Mm-hmm. And she never talked about him in the audio tapes. She never talked about him in the journals. She did say something about him in the journals that I'm not going to say. And then friends say it. But that's why I wanted him to tell his side of the story, because I thought it would be interesting for him. I mean, I wasn't going to exploit. That's not my, you know, as a filmmaker, you can exploit people's things. And I didn't want to ever do that. So I wanted him to be able to just talk about Gilda. So then I don't know how he's, how do you think he's portrayed in the film? Do you get kind of this as
you,
sort of?
I think you get the vibe that he wasn't good to her, because you also show the Lisa Loebner sketch where they're kind of being nerds, and they were like, this kind of portrays a relationship, and he's giving her really hard noogies in those sketches. Like, like he could have just kind of noogie. He's like hitting her on the head, and you're like,
it didn't register. So.
Yeah, no, that never registered to me either.
It registered. He really goes in for those noogies, and I know they're big physical comedians, but it seemed a little harsh. I was like, Bill, take it easy. You're acting. You don't have to punch her. But yeah, I think it came out, and I think there would have been more if there needed to be more. So I think you portrayed that the way it probably really happened.
Well, also, I think it's complicated too, because there were also friends of Gilda's who said he should be in it because they had a long relationship and she adored him and he adored her. So there were people that knew the both of them and felt like he should be in it. And then there were people like most of his inner circle that we got to were
his
like,
inner circle.
Yeah. Said you'll never get him.
Yeah, well, you did an amazing job of portraying it, so I think the story came across. I mean, it was such an amazing movie. Like, after you spent 4 years on it, were there any other obstacles that came up?
Well, money is really the biggest. The money.
Money. Did you notice money isn't an obstacle here?
No. <it isn't. laughs>
She loves bringing that up, well, don't you, Dev?
Well, so what happened was I got to the point where I was able to film everything. Like, I filmed Melissa McCarthy and Bill Hader and Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler. And I was able to take my footage and put it together in a trailer. And once I got the trailer, I got into something called the Hot Docs Dealmaker program.
The what?
So it's called Hot Docs Dealmaker.
Hot Docs Dealmaker? No.
Hot Docs. So Hot Docs.
No, it's a hot dog steel maker, Dev.
Not was, dogs, ducks.
No, it's like docs, like documentaries, like hot docs.
Oh, hot docs.
Hot docs. But hot dogs is good. But if you get in, it's in Toronto, and it's a big documentary conference. And if you get selected, you could ask for meetings with networks. Terrific. So I had meetings with all the big networks, and I really liked Alex, who I'd met from CNN right away, And after that, I had follow-up conversations with different networks, and then CNN came in and gave me the money that I needed to finish the film. So that was really, and it was a substantial amount of money, because there was a lot of editing, a lot of audio, a lot of clearances, a lot of licensable footage. So it wasn't, as far as documentaries go, it wasn't an inexpensive documentary.
Yeah.
Not that I'm sure they're all expensive, but this was like an extra expensive one, at least to me.
Well, it was great to be able to see it.
Thank you.
Yeah, what was it like when you finally, like when it was complete, wow, and you watched it through and you were like, we did it, and then you had the festivals and the opportunities to put it out there?
Well, I was also lucky because I was doing this on my own for so long, and I was going to different conferences and different things where I met Abby. And you meet a lot of people from the industry. So people started to know that this film was going to happen. And Tribeca Film Festival had been following the film for a while and was always asking me when it would be done. So they saw it in a pretty rough cut state, and they selected it. And then we had a call, and they said, with everyone from Tribeca, and they were wonderful, like, too. So this is a real New York, and I wanted to premiere the film in New York, because that was really because this is my hometown, and that was, like, really important to me. And we had a conference call, and they said, how would you like to be the opening night film of the Tribeca Film Festival? And that was probably the most emotional that I was.
Phenomenal offer.
Yeah, and so that was really, but the film wasn't really finished yet, so we had like 6 weeks to go.
Oh, man.
So basically the film was completed about 3 days before the festival. Like, totally complete.
It makes sense.
Just walking with confidence. Yeah, no, we've been ready. This has been good for so long.
Yeah. So you're working so hard. You know, you work so hard for years to get to different levels. And then when you're in edit, and especially the intense part, you're like, this is the edit took like 8 months in general, but like the last 2 months, it was really intense. So, and we didn't know, for me, the most important part was the audio, and that Gilda could tell her story. And it's made up of maybe even more different sources. It's made up of interviews and radio interviews and audiobooks and other interviews that journalists kept. And no one knew how it was going to sound, because all through the years people were telling me, just get an actress to read Gilda's voice. And that was I was like, no. And that probably every single person involved in the film said, you should get an actress to read it, or at least read parts of it, that, and no one will know the difference. And I said, they'll know the difference, because it's like the sort of voice. And as an actor, you know that the words are real when they're, you can tell when Gilda's Gilda, it's her voice is unique. And that was when we went into the audio postworks that did the audio, and I had a Dominic Bartoli, who's an audio who restored the so much of the tapes that so many houses throughout the world said, no, this is gone, that's a goner, you'll never use that. So that was when I heard it for the first time, the whole film. I was like, oh my God, she's telling her story. Like, that was really the big moment. So that was one of the big moments. So those were like, and then a lot of it went by in a blur. Like, the opening night of Tribeca was a blur. Like, I woke up the next morning, I was like, what happened? Can I do this all over again? I didn't really, it just was a blur. Like, and then we went to festivals, and somehow since April of last year, which I guess will be almost 10 months, it's all been sort of a blur, that when I look back and I was like, I wish I lived more in the moment of enjoying things, because you're just kind of always going. Yeah.
It's also like one of Gilda's takeaways is like living in the moment. And I think something she realized later on in life too.
Yeah, but you couldn't feel like you're living in the moment, but the moments rush by.
Yeah.
It isn't as if you...
Yeah, they just rush by, and you turn around, and it's over. And
everyone's like, going, what's next now? What's next? Like, let me enjoy that. That was good.
No, but that's the nature of living in the moment, not a personal loss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's been great. So that's – and I think also when Gilda's brother and her friends were so trustworthy, but I wanted to show they wanted to, Michael really didn't, he didn't really want to see it before, but he did. And then Alan wanted to see it. Alan and his wife, Robin, they saw it before it premiered at Tribeca. And that was a very nerve-wracking, and Paul Schaefer wanted to see it too. That was very nerve-wracking to see if they would like the film, if they would like themselves, and they loved it. So that was a really, and opening night, many of Gilda's friends from Saturday Night Live were there, makeup artists, choreographers, a lot of people that, you know, weren't famous people, but they all wanted to come. And
well, you gave an opportunity to celebrate together.
Yeah, and that's what it was. It was really like, and in some ways it's like a... it's so nice. I mean, Gilda was lucky. She had wonderful people in her life. She had really, really good friends. She had a million friends, you know, but she was a good person too. And I think she gave back to so many people. So that was, and then you get review, you know, then you also get reviews that we got a lot of really good reviews, which is great. And then we got a few, like two bad ones, which I'll remember every line.
How
of.
Is that even possible? That's troll reviewing. Yeah. If you're a human being, like, that's what Gilda Radner brought to the table. She was such, she had the inner child, and like, she represented the love and the fear that we all kind of deal with in life. Like,
but you remember the bad reviews.
I can, like, imagine.
Like, in anything you remember, like, this one person interviewed, did a review, and I saw him on Twitter, and he said something about the film, and somebody responded back and said, well, I'm going to still see it because I love Gilda. And he said, don't see it. It's not worth it. And I was like, you know, what? And those are the, but you know, out of the,
I get it.
1,000 people could say really nice things. Right. And then you remember that right. one person yeah. that, like, if you ever see them, you're going to be like, hey, you know, how dare you? Like,
I've never had one bad post on my YouTube videos or in Reddit. Never once.
Well, you know, it's also funny. Like, there's so many Gilda stories. So she lived in the Dakota, and Rex Reed was a famous, a reviewer for, I don't know if it was New York Times or where he was, but Rex Reed was the movie critic. And he gave her a bad review in Gilda Live, her movie. And she saw him once in the hallway, and she said, oh, I want to tell you, I don't know if I have the story right. She's like, I hope I didn't keep you up all night with all my crying.
Who said that?
Gilda to Rex Reed. She's like, I hope you didn't hear me throughout the with all my crying.
Oh my god! Her funniest moments came at like the hardest times. It felt like when she got put in that corner, the funny just saved her.
I think she was always funny. I think even in her diaries where she's talking about, you know, her loneliness, her eating. There's at the end of every entry. Is a moment of humor and a moment of hope. So she never, that I know of, and from what people say, she never let herself hit rock bottom. She always found a way to turn things around, which is pretty admirable.
From today's world, I'm asking, did she have therapy?
Oh, she had therapy from when she was a kid. She loved therapy.
And so
that was
really, it's a support system that.
One of her friends told the story about one of her therapists, who I never was able to find because I wanted to talk to him, but I'm not sure therapists will really tell you anything. He was telling her she needed to be more independent of him. And then she, on the night of her Broadway show, he's like sitting in the third row or something like that, or something like she's like, my therapist is out there. Like, yeah. It was a weird. But yeah, therapy was important to her and the family. Yeah, I mean, I didn't really explore that in the book because she didn't really.
Well, it's considered so private that you don't know how you can.
Yeah, she didn't really talk, but she wrote a short story about her first day at some therapist, which is actually pretty funny.
Where can it be found?
Well, that's another story. So in those boxes, Gilda left. I've been working on trying to figure out all that's in there. So she wrote a screenplay that I'm helping Michael and the estate find, develop. she wrote these screenplays, and I'm trying to think, and she wrote a wonderful 30-page book to Jean about, and it's called 10. And the significance of, and it's all stories of kids who are 10 years old, like funny little stories. And the significance is her dad got sick when she was 12, and Jean's mom got sick when he was 12. So 10 was a time where life was innocent. So there's all this amazing stuff. So I've been thinking, you know, as I'm working on new documentaries, I'm thinking of making something into a short story, like just filming it and developing, not the feature film, because that should really go to some big comedian out there with their big production company. But I'm thinking this, you know, she left behind so much, like so many good work that that should be out for the world for people to see.
Yeah, I feel, sorry, do you have something?
No, that's really would be valuable.
Yeah, and then the archives eventually they'll go to an archive. Like the
what happens when something goes to an archive?
Well, I think it depends on the archive. So that's what Michael and I have been talking about, Gilda's brother, is we don't want it, or he doesn't want it to just sit there in an archive for researchers to come in and research. We would like it more available to the public. So there's the Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York. So we've been talking about maybe at some point, they've been working with estates from what I've heard, and they're developing this great museum. To what would be great is a real exhibit out there for Gilda, where people can come, they can see her things.
How is that not out there? I mean, I know that the Comedy Center up there, and I've heard it's amazing from some other comics, but how is that not there already?
Well, we have all the stuff.
Yeah, you just kept.
I'll send you a video. He has a box of every show that Gilda's been in. Like the Saturday Night Live shirt and the Gilda Live and Second City. So there's a whole bunch of stuff. Unfortunately, one bad thing happened when Gilda's passed away. Jean took all her clothes and gave it to Goodwill, which is like, that's the one thing we're like.
I take everything I said about you back, Jean. Damn it!
And we heard there were costumes and things like that in it, like the Rosanna costumes or something.
Well, maybe he didn't know there was this.
No,
well,
we're kidding. We're kidding.
Yeah, I don't
he
think
didn't
he
know
knew.
There was this kind of research going on that he sort of subverted or.
Well, also, like when my.
It was his way of handling.
Yeah, it's also when my family passed away, you give away, you know, you donate things, and then later on you're like, oh my God, why did I do that? Like,
it probably
I wish
feels
I
good
had that.
To get rid of it, like,
or
to get
make
it out.
You feel like it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you turn, you know, and then you're like, why? But yeah, so I think Gilda needs an exhibit.
I agree. And I think you did an amazing job of capturing her life and her career. And I'm almost like ashamed that I didn't know much about her before this. I had read about her in a book and I knew of Gilda. But until I watched her movie, I mean, I learned so much about being a human being and about being a comedian. And it's like, I mean, I think everyone out there should go see this movie because it will change who you are as a person. It'll make you a little bit of a better person.
Oh, that's so nice. You know, I think what's happening is there's so many people who remember Gilda. They remember where they were when they were watching SNL. So basically the audience is people, the majority of the audience has been people over 45, 50 years old.
Aging
and
all the time.
Yeah. But I think that has always been my goal, is to have young people exposed to her, because I think her story is important, and I think her place in comedy is, so she has a solid place, you know, being inspired by Lucy and all the female comedians who come before her, and then she goes on to inspire Amy Poehler and Tina Fey and Melissa McCarthy, who are now inspiring all these younger new generation. So her place is solid. So
yeah, I mean, she was the first comedian to ever say bitch on TV, from what I heard, and also she's the first comedian she looks over, was it Chevy? Who is it? Was it Jane Curtin? She looks over and she just goes, bitch, in her old lady, in her Lisa, or with the
Emily
Littell character. And she also was the first comedian to make a joke about cancer publicly. So she's so groundbreaking.
Do we know that joke?
It's hard. So she's on Gary Shandling's show. And he has her on, and he's like, she gets this huge applause. And she's like, Gilda, you haven't been on TV in a while. And she's like, well, I had cancer. And then she goes, what did you have? And then he goes, a series of bad career moves.
Well, that was really important to Gilda. In all the audio tapes that I have of hers and her writings, is she really wanted to make cancer be something that people were not afraid of, that we're not embarrassed about. She wanted that to be a conversation. And that is over, you know, that we're talking like in the, you know, mid 1986 to 89, where people weren't, they didn't have cell phones and they weren't filming themselves. And she really brought awareness to it. She was another story that's not in the film, but is in her book, is when she first was diagnosed with cancer, the National Enquirer found her in the hospital. So she had no time to really think about, you know, and they're like, Gilda Radner in
how and
death.
What was the cancer that she had?
She had stage 4 ovarian cancer. And she had been going to doctors for a long time, and they told her she was a hypochondriac, that she had Epstein-Barr, that, you know, she wasn't working. And according to Gene Wilder's nephew, she did tell people, she would tell doctors, I have cancer, and they weren't believing her. And then she had an emergency a bowel obstruction, and she got to the hospital, and she had stage 4 cancer, ovarian cancer. And her prognosis was really bad.
Well, just listening to the title of it. Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, she was in those times with those treatments. She was probably only given 4 to 6 months to live, and she went on to live 2.5 years and go to France with Jean and play tennis and be with her friends and reunite with some of her SNL friends that she hadn't seen in years. Sorry, I'm getting...
No, get emotional. I cried a few... I've watched the documentary twice. I've cried both times. I cried during her book. She's impossible not to make you emotional. That's how good of a person she was.
Thank you for that.
Oh, thank
yes,
you.
Thank
well,
you.
It's Gilda. I mean, that's like, I watch it and I cry too because I feel bad that she's not here to be able to see it, you know?
Yeah, but I think if there is any consolation, like, you know she would appreciate it. Like, you know that spirit is still there.
Yeah.
Already.
You know, it makes life a lot richer, though. That's what you've done.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's like Gilda's such a great role model. I mean, she really is for how she lived her life. She was such a good person. She never forgot anybody's birthday. Like, just these little things.
I remember seeing that, and I was like, I need to do better at that.
I've still done bad at that.
She didn't have Facebook to tell her that everyone's birthday was that day. How did she? I can't do it with the help.
I don't know. She did have these diaries. Like, she had these diaries where she... And also, here's another thing, is we only had found about 10 of her diaries. So out there somewhere... There's diaries that either were destroyed or sitting somewhere.
It's unbelievable.
So anybody out there who may have a diary of Gilda's, please contact me.
Contact Lisa. Do you want us to give you your full address? Lisa, let us know.
And if you have home movies, don't let me know because I'll be heartbroken. Because that was another thing, is my editors and my producers and I scoured the world for, and every single person who we ever heard of who knew Gilda, you know, do you have home movies? Do you have any photos? And people gave us, you know, they went into their storage units and they found things. And some people tried to find things and couldn't, and some didn't go into their storage unit because it was too much. Because people don't like to go into their storage units. It's not a thing that, like, nobody says, hey, I'll go into my storage unit.
Yeah.
It usually takes them several months and helping people with boxes and...
Yeah, 100%. I feel like the one thing and why Gilda's story is more special is in her book, she talks a lot about the wellness community, and I think she was always in a negative mindset about cancer up until that point.
What is the wellness community?
So when Gilda got cancer, I mean, she was young, and all her friends were doing really well in show business. And I think Jane Curtin was on television and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and Chevy Chase, they're all making movies. And when she got cancer, besides being, she didn't know anyone who had cancer. And she felt so isolated. And I think it's something that everybody feels when they're diagnosed with a disease like that. And especially because she was so young. And her cancer therapist, Joanna Bull, who later goes on to found Gilda's Club, worked at a place called the Wellness Community in Santa Monica. And the Wellness Community was a cancer support organization. And the philosophy is really, you heal when you're with other people who are going through what you're going through. And she didn't want to go because she felt, you know, everyone, there would be reporters following her because of her National Enquirer experience. But she went and she loved it. And she made great friends. And she was just another, not just another person with cancer, but she was among people going through the same thing that she was going through. And she was really inspired by it. And she also gives it credit for bringing her, one of the times, bringing her humor back. Because she could just be herself. And she, and people, I mean, one thing is, every single person I ever asked about Gilda, I said, what was Gilda like? First word is funny. Like, and you think comedians would be funny, but not all. I mean, most comedians, when you, there's other things that people would say. They said she was funny. And so that was, and that she was sweet. But I think she just loved making people laugh so much that, that at the wellness community, in a place where having cancer is not funny. And that's why I love Gilda's Club so much in New York City, too, because you find people going through the most challenging things in their life, but they're going through it with positivity and humor. And that's very admirable, at least to me, because I
But you know, really need a social context with other people.
Yeah.
Not to be isolated with what's happened to you. And that becomes even more valuable because of the, what, how powerful your own experience has been.
But like a natural, my natural instinct would be to hide and be home, like, and not tell people. So I think that that's why I'm so inspired by the openness of people being with other people like that. And I think it holds through not just cancer, but anything, right? I mean, meeting other people who go through the same experience you're going through.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wonderful legacy.
Yeah, now there's Gilda's clubs all over Toronto and New York and the U.S.
Yeah.
How many clubs are there now, Dina?
I think there's 18.
Mm-hmm. 18. It's like one more. I love her career because she kind of achieved everything that you thought someone would want. SNL. She's in movies. She had her own Broadway show. And then at the end, she even has a line where she's like, I was jealous of the grocery clerk. Like, I just wanted to, like, I can make people laugh there and go home and be happy. And, her legacy, in my opinion, is so important because it was beyond stage comedy. It was more about live comedy, and now what she's done, what I can only imagine for all these people who now have somewhere to go because of Gilda's clubs, and to me that it's like, what an impact! You can't beat that.
And you see her picture, like if you go downtown to Gilda's club, there's a mural when you walk in, and there's different pictures of Gilda there. So the moment you walk in, you're embraced by Gilda.
What was the force that turned her into such a phenomenal, you know, that there were clubs of her? I mean, there had to be somebody wanting that to happen.
Yeah, so when Gilda was going to the wellness community in Santa Monica, that was the only place for people to go for support. But her and Jean also lived in Connecticut, in Stamford, Connecticut. So when she would come back to New York, she would have no support. So apparently she started her own little support group in her house in Connecticut, and people would come. And her dream was really, her wish was for there to be more what they were, wellness communities at the time. And so her friend, her best friend Pam, who's in the movie, opened up a wellness community in Boston. So that was like the first one.
And basically the wellness community was to have people with cancer come together.
Yeah, and their families and friends. So it wasn't just supported for people with cancer. It was supporting the whole family. It was supporting the children, supporting people who lost people with cancer, people who were taking care of people with cancer, and with people with cancer. So it was sort of the whole...
That's brilliant and unique.
Yeah. And so Joanna Bull, who was Gilda's cancer therapist, and Gene Wilder were the ones who opened up Gilda's Club in New York City. So that was the impetus
it's like a haunted house.
Okay, Gilda comes. Yeah. Gilda does come in at like shoots.
Yeah, I think weird, like, it was Elijah and Gilda just came into the room.
So it wasn't just her spirit.
Lisa, has been an honor and a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thanks. It's been great.
Everyone, do yourselves a favor. Go watch Love, Gilda. You can stream it on Hulu. You can rent it on Amazon. Also, if you can, donate some money to Gilda's clubs because they provide their cancer wellness community services for free with the help of funding. So donate to their... Watch the video. And Lisa, what's next for you? Anything?
Well, two things. You can go to Cancer Support Community online and see all the Gilda's clubs and the cancer support communities throughout the country. So if you need support, you can go there. Also, if you do still have a DVD player, we have a DVD out that has 30 minutes of bonus material, like my favorite things that weren't in the film. So that's that. For me, there's all these Gilda projects, and I'm also developing a couple documentaries at the moment. I really love telling the story of very inspiring women. I mean, I'm sure they're inspiring men too.
No, but, I get but, it. I'm deeply offended. How dare you?
But I, you know, and Gilda's a hard one to follow up with, but yeah, that's kind of the same. I'm
what have
developing.
Nothing. Or who have you found?
Well, I've been developing something on Coco Chanel. And
I know nothing. Okay.
She's a designer.
Yeah.
But she's really complex. Like, she, whereas Gilda is just a good person, Coco Chanel was this groundbreaking designer. She came from nothing to become one of the richest women in the world, but she didn't necessarily do it in the most positive way. So her story is more complex. So I'm developing that. And then I'm looking, you know, any suggestions about, like comedians who... I mean, I do love comics because there's something really fun about being in the world of comedy. So, like, anyone that you remember that just has a great story, unsung... Like, Gilda is an unsung hero.
I mean,
so
when I think of older... Like, Joan Rivers was... But I imagine there's a million stories and documentaries about her.
Yeah, there's one that's been out.
Yeah.
But I also heard that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, Gilda was not a big fan of Joan Rivers.
Because she's kind of the antithesis. She was kind of like snarky and mean. And
yeah, and Gilda felt like, from the stories that she heard, they were both at Second City. And for Gilda, being in improv, it was to work with the people, whereas Joan Rivers got her laughs from throwing people under the bus many times. So that was kind of the opposite.
Yeah, yeah,
humor.
That's really interesting.
How do you throw people under the bus?
Literally, Dev, literally.
She's talking about you.
I guess it's like, so I don't know if I could tell the story right, but like it would be like if, I don't know if you're living in the moment and you're doing a scene and then you're all of a sudden you're making fun of them or you're not getting what they're getting or your joke is at the expense of them instead of the joke. Yeah, I don't know.
Punching up versus punching down.
Yeah, throw people under the bus. Yeah, I don't know how that relates. That's pretty dramatic. That's it. That is a dramatic statement I made. I guess that
No. Deb just takes everything very literally.
No, I just yeah. wanted... I don't. If you don't have examples of something that are unique, then they're dramatic, but they don't land anywhere.
Well, okay. I don't know if I could tell the story right then, but I'll try. So apparently when you audition for The Second City, you have a partner and you do the same scene three different ways. Hmm. And I think she was sitting at a desk and this guy comes in, they do their little sketch. And then they do it again. And then he comes in and she's like, "You again? Why are you walking in here?" And then he's all thrown. Like, I think it's like throwing, maybe it's throwing something at somebody that is hard for them to react to, but you could get a laugh from it. But then they're like, what do
I say? It doesn't
help
the greater good. It's selfishness versus being a team player, which is what improv and group comedy is all about.
Really?
Oh, then improv classes I used to take, there was like the kid who's trying so hard to get everyone to laugh at me. And and then you learn very quickly that selfish behavior just ruins a scene and doesn't help the comedy.
So you were throwing people under the bus.
I didn't really. You learn through improv classes, there's a few examples of it, but
I think
everyone
he was thrown under the bus. I don't know if that's...
It was all of the above. It was all. But we lived and we learned and we moved forward.
But that is a pretty dramatic thing when it comes to comedy, that statement, though. Because you're not really thrown under a bus. I mean, you survive.
Yeah, but it's the feeling when someone does it to you is like, really, motherfucker? So it's that feeling of someone doing something that wrong to you. So
that's about as seriously insulted as you can get.
As a comedian, mm-hmm. 100%. Comedy first, you second. That's how it works.
I never heard that summarized before.
Well, you have now. Well, Lisa, we look forward to everything else you have coming out. It was so great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's great hanging out with you guys, and I really love what you two have going. The podcasts are really funny and really good. We're glad. Inspirational, too.
Well, and if we can get the word of Gilda out there and people like you who are doing good work, then I think we're doing some justice as well.
Good point.
And as long as we have bagels, everything's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, bagels do make a serious difference.
All right. Well, good luck with all your future projects. Again, everyone, support all the causes we mentioned earlier. What was the site again?
CancerSupportCommunity.com.
CancerSupportCommunity.com, Gilda's Club, and watch the movie. Love Gilda. It's so good. And until then, guys, remember, stay happy, stay funny.
Stay alive.